Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Cognitive Dissidence. As usual, I'm your host. I'm Jacob Shapiro. I'm also a partner and the director of geopolitical analysis at Cognitive Investments. Joining me on the podcast for the first time is Emre Doğru. Emre is managing partner at Corpera Consulting. Emre and I both worked at Stratfor back in the day. He's a great geopolitical analyst and in general analyst who is based in Turkey. And I turned to Emre for guidance, first of all, on how to pronounce the name of, Turkish opposition politicians, which, as you will hear in the episode, is not as easy as it sounds, but also to get an on-the-ground perspective on what's going on in Turkey. I say this often on this podcast. I think English language media is very bad at reporting on and analyzing things that are going on in countries that we have our own preconceived notions about. I think that is especially true of Turkey and of the Erdogan government in particular. That is in no way to justify or support or even criticize the things that the Erdogan government is doing. That's not why you come to this podcast. You come to this podcast for objective analysis. We're trying to put away our biases, understand what is going on in Turkey, understand what's going to happen next, and see if there are opportunities as well. So thank you for Emre for coming on and for talking at that level of the conversation. Listeners, jacob@cognitive.investments is my email address. If you want to hear more about the research that we sell, about the services that we provide in terms of managing client assets, please write to me there. You can also write to me with feedback about this podcast. We've been getting a lot of interesting feedback actually lately, so I want to thank you for that. A lot of you seem to really like the Gary Golden episode last week because you disagreed with many things in it, and that's the job here. I'm trying to bring different thoughtful perspectives that can expand your thinking. So Emre and I recorded here on Wednesday, March 22nd. This was originally not going to publish for another week and a half, but I thought the things that Emre talked about were so pressing that we actually pushed the episode we were going to post on Monday another week back, and we're going to put this one out as soon as we can on Monday. Thank you for being along for the ride. Cheers. See you out there. Cognitive Investments LLC is a registered investment advisor. Advisory services are only offered to clients or prospective clients where Cognitive and its representatives are properly licensed or exempt from licensure. For additional information, please visit our website at www.cognitive.investments. The information provided is for educational and informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice, and it should not be relied on as such. It should not be considered a solicitation to buy or an offer to sell a security. It does not take into account any investor's particular investment objectives, strategies, tax status, or investment horizon. You should consult your attorney or tax advisor. Emre, it's so nice to have you on the podcast. We've been dancing around it, and you're joining a parade of ex-Stratfor people coming on the show. So happy to have you here.
Thank you, man. I'm happy to be here.
Can I start off with a really, it's a dumb question, but I'm tired of embarrassing myself. I don't know how to pronounce the opposition candidate's name.
that's a bit difficult to pronounce. It's Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
Kılıçdaroğlu? Is that
yes.
Right?
Yes. You're doing better than I thought.
Well, thank you. That's so kind. All right. Well, if I say it wrong in the course of the podcast, please correct me. Don't let me embarrass myself. But sure. Kılıçdaroğlu. Okay, cool. I'm going to write that down for myself. But before we get into Turkish politics, I wanted to let's talk a little bit about the earthquake that happened in February. I know that you've been active in helping folks on the ground with the earthquake. What do you think the economic impact of it is going to be? It's sort of doubly interesting because I feel like in the late 90s, there was also a major earthquake when you had a big banking crisis in Turkey and a lira crisis, and that was part of what Erdogan rose to power. So there are these weird synergies in Turkish history that seem to be repeating themselves. But what is the economic impact of the earthquake? Do you think Turkey's going to be experiencing this for years, decades? How do we think about this?
Sure. I mean, the earthquake, as you know, took place on the 6th of February, early in the morning, around 4 a.m., and it was such a big earthquake. Actually, there were two earthquakes, and, you know, it was such a devastating event that took place in 11 provinces in southeastern Turkey, which unfortunately resulted in the death of 50,000 people as of now, and more than 100 people injured. So the human cost of this event was such a devastating one, and you know, it was such a depressing moment for the entire country as well. I mean, not only for the people who live in that region, but also the people who live in other parts of Turkey, in the western part of Turkey, because, you know, of course, everybody was exposed to all this, you know, upsetting images and videos, and, you know, people were really trying to help out their friends or relatives, or even for other people who they don't know. There was such a huge social mobilization in various parts of Turkey. especially in Istanbul, Ankara, and also in major cities, which are the major economic powerhouses of the country. So it was such a big event, and as you said, and as you briefly mentioned, which we can talk about later, it seems like the history is repeating itself, and it seems like one of the major milestones in Turkish political and economic history. So as you said, all the calculations and all the assessments show that there will be a huge economic cost on the country as well, because even though this region is not the most important, significant region economically, there are still provinces that are very much industrialized, such as Gaziantep, Hatay, Adana, and others. So overall, this region, which stands for like 10% of Turkish GDP, is such an important region for Turkey. It's also important for, and as I know that this is one of the areas that you're also focusing on, it's also one of the areas that is important for agricultural production as well. So Turkey is already dealing with an increase in food prices. And this area produces like 15% of Turkish agriculture products. So there will be a cost on this as well. But coming back to the overall economic cost for the country, as I said, it's like 10% of Turkey's GDP. And the area exports like more than 8%, 8.5% of Turkey's exports, which was... $250 billion dollar last year in 2022. So 8.5% of Turkey's exports, and it contributes to the tax collection of the central government, again by 8% or so. So it's not the most significant area economically speaking, but of course it has it's going to have a big impact on the Turkish economic situation and macroeconomic environment. In addition to that, according to some estimates by the World Bank, by JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley, of course, there will be a cost that is caused by the damage that took place in that area, right? So there is a cost of damage of housing cost, of course, which stands for, according to the different calculations, it stands between 25 to 30 billion US dollar. And then, of course, there are indirect costs as well, such as infrastructure, roads, bridges, other things. And of course, a lot of people, these two earthquakes led to one of the biggest internal migrations inside the country. So a lot of people moved from the region to Ankara or to the western part of the country, which means that employment and of course, labor productivity will decrease in that area as well. So it will have an indirect cost on the economy. So taking together direct and indirect costs, it seems like it's going to amount to 45 or 50 billion US dollar. And of course, there will be a lot of construction going on in the region in the coming months and probably years. The government promised to rebuild the apartments, the houses, in 1 year or so. But of course, based on all the estimates, to truly rebuild everything that was demolished there will probably take many more years, like from 3 to 5 years. Partly because, the area is a remote area, and then, Turkey will need to import some construction materials, which will, by the way, will also have an impact on Turkish macroeconomic balance as well. So it seems like this, construction material imports will add to at least 1% to Turkey's current account deficits, which is the structural problem of the Turkish economy, right? So the current account deficits, it's the historical problem of Turkish economy. And it also will increase Turkey's budget deficit as well. So according to JP Morgan's estimate, it will increase from 3.5% as of GDP, of course, to 4.5%. So Turkey is likely to face what is, I think, called a twin deficit problem. On the one hand, the current account deficit, and on the other hand, budget deficit, which might create some sort of course, vulnerability in terms of economic balance.
We were also talking before we hit the record button that it's not just this region that is subject to earthquakes. So is there And we know that, I mean, a lot of the buildings didn't perform that well, and it seemed like there was a lot of scandal around what was built to code and what wasn't built to code and what was left standing. Are there concerns that other Turkish cities are going to have to be sort of rebuilt or reinforced so that this doesn't happen again? Is that something that Turkey can even afford, or do you just have to sort of, you know, cross your fingers and pray that this doesn't happen again?
Well, I mean, that's a very complicated question because, I mean, you know, majority of the Turkish population became geologists over the couple of weeks. I mean, we have been reading and watching a lot of interviews and reading a lot of articles about the earthquake and its impact and how it can be measured, and of course, the coding of housing and other things. One of the main questions that people have in mind, and this is, I think, something that creates a lot of anxiety in the other parts of the country as well with the majority of the population, is that the next big earthquake that Turkey is expecting is going to take place in the Marmara region, which is the economic powerhouse of the country, right? So Istanbul, and also the area surrounding Istanbul, the industrial zone of Turkey, Kocaeli and the Marmara region, is basically Turkey's, you know, majority of Turkey's economy. Just to give you a sense, like 50% of Turkey's GDP is from Istanbul, right? So it's 20 million people. So that's a very big headache for everybody here. And the main problem is that, of course, there are a lot of houses that were built many, many years ago, like 30, 40 years ago, which is when the coding standards were not properly established. So most of the houses were constructed according to this lax codes, and they are considered to be unsafe. But then the problem is that how do you make unsafe houses safe right now? You know, you can't demolish them and reconstruct new ones. That means, you know, people need to move in and out and, you know, maybe other parts of the country. There is already a kind of housing crisis in Istanbul, like the rents and housing prices just skyrocketed over the past couple of years. The middle class wage earners can hardly afford a proper apartment, like a two-bedroom apartment in the center of the town right now. So if this needs to be done according to the plan, you know, it's a huge economic and social cost that comes with. And you know, there are even plans and strategies about how to move millions of people from Istanbul to maybe other regions of Turkey, like to central Anatolia. Whether it is possible to do this, or whether at least some industrial zones can be moved from other parts of the country, because Istanbul, as it stands right now, it seems hardly possible to renovate, and the urban regeneration projects are very costly to do, both economically and it comes with political cost, because people are reacting to politicians. So whoever wins the Istanbul municipality in the next term, as you know, since 2019, it's the opposition camp that rules Istanbul and Ankara. So whoever wins next time and maybe the term after that, the main agenda in Istanbul and other parts of the region will be definitely the earthquake and how to renovate all these houses.
I sympathize with that comment you made about everybody becoming seismologists after the earthquake. Every hurricane season here in New Orleans, I feel like I become a hurricane expert and I start, you know, pushing the little pins on the map and trying to figure everything out. So, but I guess I don't know much about Istanbul's history from that point of view, and maybe I should have a seismologist on the podcast, but does Istanbul have a history of devastating earthquakes like that?
Yes. It does. I mean, it happens every like 200 years, and so according to the TED kind of time calculation, it's really getting near. I mean, some of the seismologists, they're like geologists, they're like more in an urgency mode, you know, they're saying that it's coming, you know, we just have like maybe a couple of years left. And some of them are saying that, well, you know, these calculations are not truly accurate. Of course, you know, when it comes to earthquake, it's not, you know, possible to forecast, 100% certainty. But there definitely is a risk. As you said at the beginning, the biggest earthquake that took place in the region, not necessarily in Istanbul, but in Kocaeli, which is near Istanbul, and which is also an industrial zone near Istanbul, that took place in 1999. And that was, and this is something maybe we can discuss later, it was a turning point in Turkish political history, which, as you briefly mentioned, was also one of the driving forces behind Erdogan's rise to the power. So that biggest earthquake that took place in 1999 actually created a sense of distrust among the Turkish public regarding the Turkish government and the state capacity, because a lot of people thought that, well, I mean, as a result of all the scandals and corruption scandals and everything that took place during the 1990s, the state capacity has decreased immensely. So, and there is now an earthquake, and people basically felt that they were left alone, right? And that's really, and that was also exacerbated by the financial crisis that took place in 1999 and 2001, and that wiped out all the former political parties and led to the, you know, justice and the ruling justice and development parties rise to the power.
Well, this is sort of a back way to get into talking about the elections, because there's so much uncertainty about the elections. But to bridge into that conversation, I want to ask, do you think it's similar to 1999? Do you feel like there's a similar level of distrust that is getting applied to this Turkish government and to Erdogan in particular? I ask because, you know, you mentioned the polls say that Kılıçdaroğlu is doing well. You know, Daily Sabah and everybody else is like, actually, the polls say the exact opposite. Erdogan's doing great. Like, he's going to win. Don't listen to these opposition polls. So I almost feel like the polls in this case are more confusing than they are clarifying. So I have no idea to know whether Erdogan's up in the polls, whether he's down in the polls, what the opposition is doing. And I guess I'd start our conversation about elections by saying, do you think this earthquake is fatal to Erdogan's chances to be reelected? Do you think the economy was already bad enough anyway and people distrusted him? How do we think about how the earthquake's going to affect him? And then maybe we can talk more broadly about the elections in general.
Sure. I mean, the earthquake will definitely have an impact on the, you know, on the Turkish population, Turkish people's perception of the political parties, not necessarily or specifically for the people, for the voters who live in that region, but also from the entire country. Because, you know, even President Erdogan admitted himself that the rescue efforts were not sufficient, especially in the first 48 hours. So there are you know institutions that were recently established, such as you know, the AFAD, others, and they were not seen as sufficient to provide the necessary assistance to that region. So to be fair, of course, it was one of the biggest, you know, natural disasters that took place in country's history. Like, it was not a trivial event, right? So probably any government or any state would have faced difficulties in that sense. So it's a very vast region, comprised of like 13 to 15 million people population, 11 provinces. You know, it's a very widespread area with, you know, remote areas where villages are. So it was a very difficult situation for any government to deal with. But still, of course, the people who live there, especially in some specific towns. It seems like they were putting the blame on the government for not being able to provide necessary assistance, as I said, especially in the first 48 hours, because this is the, you know, the emergency situation where people under the hubris, you know, they're looking for assistance, and then, you know, when there is no enough or sufficient rescue efforts, then, you know, people feel like they're left alone, just as it happened back in 1999. So it will definitely have an impact. And it seems like, you know, according to the latest polls, it seems like it had a negative impact on the Justice and Development Party's support by like 2-3%. But still, the Justice and Development Party is the, you know, the leading party in the polls. So when it comes to the, maybe we can talk about this in detail, but on the May 14th, we are going to vote for two things, right? First, the president, and second, the parliament. Mm-hmm. And this is taking place for the first time. So it's a bit complicated situation for an ordinary citizen, right? So how to decide whom to vote and, you know, what kind of voting strategy that you're going to have in mind. So is it better to, you know, create a balance of power between the parliament and the president, or is it much better to give all the power to president and his ruling party? So there are a lot of things that are happening here. And then last year, there was also a change to the electoral law. So we don't really know what kind of impact that is going to have, especially in the distribution of the seats in the parliament. This is an uncharted territory for all of us, including, you know, President Erdogan himself and his opponents, and also for the Turkish voters.
I'm going to ask you a controversial question, and I don't want it to be controversial necessarily, because I feel like, especially in English language media, it is impossible to get a straight take on what's going on in Turkey. I mean, Anne Applebaum in that famous Atlantic article, "The Bad Guys Are Winning," Erdogan was one of the bad guys. In the West, Erdogan's like Putin and Xi and Lukashenko and Maduro. He's kind of getting thrown in with these other authoritarians. And I don't want to touch that hot topic, but I do want to ask somebody who's in Turkey, who's in Istanbul, for whom this is personally, you know, affecting them. Do you think Turkey is still a democracy? Do you feel that any of the changes that have happened in the last decade or under Erdogan's rule have undermined Turkish democracy? Or is it still no? Like, actually, Erdogan has a lot to worry about here at the polls, and this narrative about how he's an authoritarian and things like that. Yes, he's changed the constitution. Yes, he's done all these other things. But yes, maybe he's even stacked the deck and gone after opposition media and things like that. But if enough Turks vote against Erdogan, like, he will not be president and he will kind of go away. So I take that question however you want, but I don't want it to be ideological. I just sort of, on an objective level, do you feel like Turkey is still a democracy, or do you feel like that's at risk?
I mean, especially since the constitutional change that took place in 2017, and then, you know, Erdogan's election as the, you know, the second term as the president in that new political regime in 2018, of course, there was a lot of concentration of power, right? So the presidency, the president himself, gained a lot of powers in terms of legislative issues and executive issues and appointments of high-level public officials. So it was, you know, the concentration of power and the executive power of the president, was the main thing in Turkey. So, and the president himself and his ruling Justice and Development Party justified this by saying that, look, we live in a very troubled region, and Turkey is a very big country. So we need to be fast in making our decisions. And we are, of course, going to consult with you, and we are going to make very fast decisions. And, you know, this is how we can survive and prosper in this troubled region of the world. And this is how we can come up with some strategic projects, such as the production of national Turkish car, such as the drones and other things, you know, the big national pride projects. So up until the earthquake, I think it's paid off very well for the government and the President Erdogan. But with the earthquake, now the population might have some second thought about, well, is the so much concentration of power within the hands of, you know, an inner circle within the government, is a good or bad thing? So it seems like this political regime, which is, you know, semi-presidential regime, let me put it this way, you know, is being more and more questioned by, not only by the Turkish people, not only by the Turkish voters, but also by, you know, different stakeholders and institutions as well. So coming back to your question, whether Turkey is still a democracy, yes, it's still a democracy. I mean, there is a functioning parliament, though the parliament's powers, both legislative powers and supervision powers, have decreased immensely. But still, there are, like, you know, functioning institutions inside the government. And I truly believe that, you know, since 1950, Turkey had, free and fair elections. This is something that the Turkish people are very much proud of. If there is a change of government, there will be a smooth transition. I mean, there is no question about it.
To what extent do you think that what's driving people's votes in this upcoming election is political versus economic? So, I mean, Turkey's had a lot of economic problems, and we can talk about them. I would love to talk about the current account deficit and why that's always Turkey's problem, and how, you know, Turkey's a country, we're worried about 10% inflation, you know, or 8% inflation in the US or in the UK. You know, Turkish inflation was, what, 80%, 85% it topped out last year. So it's kind of a whole different thing. But are people motivated, you think, by that political conversation? Because if you listen to the opposition parties, they're saying, hey, we're going to come in and we're going to repeal all this nonsense with the president. We're going to go back to the system as it was before. We're going to return things as before. Do you think that's what's driving people? Or is what's driving people, hey, the economy has been kind of weird, and Erdogan's been doing weird things with the economy, and you throw the earthquake thing on top of it? Like, where do you think, or what is driving public sentiment right now, or what is driving support for the opposition?
I mean, let me start with the support with Erdogan first, because it is quite an interesting story. I mean, it seems like, you know, look at all the polls in Turkey, no matter how much reliable they are. And I mean, look at all different questions. You know, it can be, you know, would you vote for Erdogan? Would you vote for Justice and Development Party? Or some specific issues that, you know, people are divided on, right? So such as, you know, women's rights or, you know, economic problems or foreign policy issues. One third of the Turkish population, you know, approximately one third of the Turkish population stands behind President Erdogan no matter what happens. So his core constituent still is above 30%. So for nowadays, it's like 30, 32, 33. So what is driving support for Erdogan is mostly identity politics. And the fact that it is, he is a leader who basically, he pulled a majority of the Turkish population from, you know, being underserved or being really, you know, lacking wealth and, you know, being in under the, you know, bad socioeconomic conditions. And they created a new middle class that is more conservative, religiously speaking and culturally speaking, but has more things to demand from the government. So people who believe that the Turkish people, especially the Western analysts and observers who believe that the Turkish people will just vote based on economic motivations are not 100% accurate. And the second thing is that we need to always keep in mind when Erdogan took power back in 2002, the GDP per capita in Turkey was slightly above 2,000 US dollar per person. Okay. And nowadays it's, above 9,000. So, I mean, at some point it was almost like 12,000, you know, back in 2010, 2011. So when Turkey was making that big jump with EU reforms and the flow of foreign direct investment into Turkey. So there was a lot of increase in, you know, wealth in the daily life, and especially with the middle class. Nowadays, it's decreasing, but still, it's much better than what was happening back in 1990s and early 2000s. So coming back to your question about the support with opposition, I think what is driving, and this is a complicated thing, but what is driving the support for opposition is basically opposition against Erdogan. You know, there is a coalition of political parties, leftists, Kurds, nationalists, secularists, conservatives, Islamists, you know, whoever you call, they're all allying around what is called the Table of Six, or the National Alliance, as it's called. So the Table of Six, and they're basically, the whole purpose is to, you know, gain the power and, after that, in 1.5 years or in 2 years, make all the necessary reforms and go back to parliamentary system and change the constitution, for which actually they will need a lot of seats in the parliament or a support in the referendum. So according to the Turkish constitution, maybe this is a bit detailed, but it's important to keep in mind is that a Turkish parliament is composed of 600 members, and for any bloc to change the constitution without a referendum, they need the approval of 400 members. So it's two thirds. So it's a big majority. You need a big majority. If you get like 360, you can go for a referendum, which is also a big campaign. So the opposition bloc basically promises that, you know, we're going to make all the economic and political reforms, and we're going to change the constitution, and we're going to go back to the parliamentary system. But this time we're going to have a much better parliamentary system. we're going to improve the powers of the parliament and basically give more power to the people who directly elect them. And this ties back to the argument that I made earlier, is that it seems like, especially with the implications of the earthquake, there is a reaction against so much concentration of power in the hands of President Erdogan and his inner circle.
Well, that's funny though, because I would have thought based on what you were saying that, I mean, so it sounds like the Turkish government didn't acquit itself very well in the first 48 or 72 hours after the earthquake, although I accept it was a terrible crisis and probably no government could have done a good enough job to satisfy people at all. But the earthquake is almost exactly the type of example that a stronger executive presidency was designed for. Like, you need somebody who can go in and say, or let's extend it to what we were talking about earlier. An executive president go to Istanbul and say, I don't care that this is going to cost a lot of money. We have to fix this city. So I'm going to ram this through. And like, we are going to fix Istanbul because we can't have what happened in this part of the region happen in Istanbul. In some ways, it gives the kind of justification for that, because if you're in that parliamentary system and everybody's horse trading and arguing and not actually things, it kind of under, I don't know, does
that's
that
exactly the question that people have in mind, I guess, right now. I mean, that's you know, the performance in the earthquake, especially as I said in the first 48 hours, was created a big question mark regarding the benefits and the disadvantages of the presidential system.
Well, yeah. And in some ways, like the fact, like all the building codes and things like that, that came in the parliamentary system. So if you're the opposition, you're saying we're going back to the parliamentary system when we built all these things not to code and nothing was kind of observed. That's one thing too. I take your point too. You talked about GDP per capita. If you just look at straight GDP, I mean, when Erdogan came to power originally in the late 90s, Turkey was, you know, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, all relatively equivalent. Turkey has left them all behind now. I mean, Turkey's really the only modern industrial economy in the region. Saudi Arabia would love to have the level of sophistication and industry that you have in Turkey in their own economy, and who knows if they'll actually be able to do it. So Erdogan has been able to deliver growth. I know that this is an impossible question to answer, but I will ask it and put you on the spot a little bit, which is to say, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think Erdogan's going to win? Do you think that it's going to be the AKP wins, but some other presidential candidate comes in and we get lots of fireworks? Obviously, there are months to go here, but which direction is your analysis leaning right now?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of scenarios. So the first scenario is that, according to the Turkish constitution right now, on the May 14th, we are going to vote for both presidential and the parliamentary composition. And if no candidate gets more than 50% of the votes as the presidential candidate in the first round, then there will be a second round. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that before looking into the presidential election, I think we really need to understand what's going to happen in the parliamentary distribution. Because the Justice and Rule Development Party and its main ally, the Nationalist Movement Party, together it seems like they're going to get like 40% of the votes. Okay, and according to some calculations that I think are credible, the recently changed electoral law could make it possible that the Justice and Development Party and the Nationalist Movement Party together can gain more than half of the seats in the parliament. Mm. Okay, so assuming that there is no winner as the president in the first round, we don't know how the Turkish people will react to that in the second round. Okay, so let's assume a situation where the ruling camp gained more than half of the seats in the parliament, and we're going to the second round for the presidential election. So we don't know how the Turkish people will behave in this way because we haven't experienced this before. Yeah. So it might be the case that, you know, the majority of the people who didn't vote for Erdogan in the first round might go and say that, well, you know, now they have the majority in the parliament, maybe it's a better idea to elect President Erdogan again in the second round, so that the system will not become inefficient as a result of the disagreements and conflicts between the parliament and the president. Mm-hmm. But as it stands right now, the opposition's candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, is leading the polls. And if nothing happens on the way, you know, it might be the case that the opposition's candidate might win in the first round. But we should not never, ever, ever forget that President Erdogan is a very skilled politician. You know, like him or dislike him, he's like one of the most skilled politician in this country. So he's also called like election campaigner machine, right? So we don't really know what's going to happen when he goes to the field and then, you know, he starts campaigning. So he might be really convincing when it comes to, you know, appealing to the feelings and the minds of the Turkish people. So he speaks the language of the Turkish people. So we don't know what's going to happen. Another thing to keep in mind is that, and this is a bit of a detailed legal debate, but there's a lot of constitutional controversy regarding whether or not Erdogan can run as a president this time. Because he was elected as president in the firstly in 2014, and then second in 2018. So according to the current constitution, the constitution says that a president can only run for 2 terms. So, you know, legally speaking, the next election might be considered as Erdogan's 3rd term, which is, according to the constitution, is impossible. But the counter argument to that is that the period between 2014 and 2018 doesn't count because Turkey was not a presidential system back then. So President Erdogan himself and his, of course, his supporters are claiming that the 2-term limit started in 2018, not in 2014. So there might be a lot of legal challenges and constitutional controversy regarding his candidacy. And on the other hand, as I said, you know, the thing that puts together and cements the opposition is the opposition against Erdogan himself, which is not an ideological alignment, or, you know, probably they have a lot of different ideas and thoughts about, you know, how this country should be run. But, you know, as I said, all these different political factions basically for the moment came together and they said that, okay, let's get rid of the system first. Let's, you know, retire Erdogan and then we're going to take care of the rest. That being said, we still have, I mean, there's like 50, 45 days until the elections. So there might be some frictions within the opposition camp as well. Yep. And as we speak today, there was a press conference from some of the opposition political parties regarding, you know, no, we don't want the support of the Kurdish political party for the presidential candidate. If they're supporting our candidate, then we are not going to support. So there are all kinds of, you know, ups and downs within the opposition camp. And, you know, everybody in the opposition camp are like, fingers crossed, we hope that they are not going to break apart. So this is what opposition voters think. And of course, the voters of Erdogan anxiously waiting for the opposition to crumble.
Yeah, I take all of your points there. Well, let's turn to the opposition, because the opposition, and I want to talk about what policy is going to look like, whether Erdogan wins or whether the opposition wins, or, you know, everything else and in between. The opposition is saying it's going to do things really differently. They're going to return to a parliamentary system. They're going to welcome Finland and Sweden into NATO. They're going to, you know, immediately turn against Russia, all of these different sorts of things. Geopolitics would tell us that policy is probably not going to be that difficult. Turkey's a rising geopolitical power. As you mentioned, it's in a very difficult neighborhood. It has all these aspirations. You would think that those aspirations are there, whether you're in the CHP or whether you're in the AKP or anything else. So do you think that that's all just election nonsense, or do you think there would be real policy changes? And you're probably going to tell me it depends, you know, how much is in the parliament, I mean, versus the president. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, foreign policy might be one of the fronts where we're going to continue to see actually changes no matter who wins. Because both the government is indicating changes in foreign policy choices, and the opposition is very open in saying that, you know, we are going to change our relations with the West, normalize our ties with the United States, with the European Union. We're going to push for some EU-driven reforms. And the opposition presidential candidates, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, has been saying this for many, many years, that there needs to be a normalization of ties with the Syrian regime as well. As you know, one of the main issues that the Turkish people are debating is the Syrian refugees here, the immigrants, which we think, according to the official figures, is around like 5 million people. So it's a huge cost economically and socially. So the opposition is basically promising that they will be, you know, they will be sent back as a result of normalization with the Assad regime. The chief foreign policy advisor and former ambassador of the opposition presidential candidate, he recently gave some remarks to Western media regarding normalizing ties with NATO, with the United States, and with the European Union. So there is going to be a change in the direction of Turkish foreign policy, no matter who wins. The reason that I'm saying no matter who wins is because the current government is also changing its foreign policy choices. I mean, look at what has been happening over the past 1 year or so. I mean, Turkey normalized its ties with the UAE, right? So the country was like arch enemy of Turkey, for especially after the attempted military coup, right? Most recently, Turkish foreign minister had a meeting with the Egyptian foreign minister to normalize ties. And according to reports that I have seen, the Egyptian government wanted Turkey to extradite Muslim Brotherhood members who are in exile in Turkey, so which is a big controversy, of course. Turkey normalizes ties with Israel as well, right? So, which was, as you and I know very well, very much deteriorated after the Marmara Flotilla accident and the things that happened afterwards. So there is a lot of change in Turkish foreign policy, and it seems like it's going to continue to change in the coming months and years. And most recently, Bashar Assad was in Moscow, and it seems like there was a discussion between Vladimir Putin and Bashar Assad regarding whether or not the Syrian regime should normalize its ties with Turkey. But according to reports that we have seen, Bashar Assad was not very much convinced. So that is still on hold for a moment, especially it seems like before the elections. But it's no secret that the government itself, or not only the opposition, but the government itself, is also looking for ways to change its foreign policy choices. So, as you said, it's a difficult region, but I believe that Turkey has a great potential to be one of the attraction centers in the region. I mean, it's a big country, you know, it's an industrial country, as you said. One of the reasons is because Turkey doesn't have much natural resources, so the Turkish economy had to grow based on production. Now that production is still not that sophisticated, so the high-tech products and the share of Turkey's export is still very, very low, like 2-3%, which is one of the reasons why there is a lot of problem with the current account deficit and others. But Turkey can really become an attraction center, both politically and economically, in this troubled region.
What about Turkey's relationships with Russia and China in particular? Because this is one area where, you know, Erdogan says he wants to be a leader of the Muslim world and wants Turkey to be a leader of the Muslim world. And yet, Turkey doesn't seem to have much problems with China, despite everything that's been happening in Xinjiang. Turkey's relationship with Russia, I understand it's pragmatic because Turkey imports a lot of energy and a lot of food from Russia in general, and Turkey needs to be pragmatic. It doesn't want to have a confrontation with a historical rival like Russia. But Russia's shown itself to be a lot weaker. Turkey's still being super pragmatic, even though you have a bunch of, you know, offshore gas deposits, it looks like, that will be able to get at least some of that dependence on Russia away. I am sure that there are Canadian farmers and U.S. farmers and farmers across the Western world who would love to export their wheat to Turkey and, you know, sort of muscle out Russia's exports there. How do you think about Turkey's relation? I don't want to rehash the past, but where do you think Turkey's relationships with Russia and China go forward from here? Are there changes there? Do you think that whether it's the opposition or Erdogan, it will continue to be pragmatic? Could you see Turkey sort of saying, okay, well, this whole Russia, China, Iran, Saudi nexus, we don't like this. Maybe we should look a little bit more west. Maybe we need to balance a little bit more. How does Turkey think about it from that point of view?
Well, I mean, in the minds of the current government, Turkey needs to be a balancing power between the West and the East, right? So if you read the books that's, the foreign policy establishment of the current government has written, it becomes quite clear that they have this idea of Turkey being very much, imbalancedly dependent on the Western alliance. So whatever Turkey has done thus far in the minds of the current government was to kind of balance itself that problem, right? So Turkey has become, especially after the downing of the jet near the Syrian border that took place in 2015, and the assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, Turkey and Russia has agreed on three, like, very strategic and important projects. So the purchasing of S-400s, the natural gas pipeline called Turk Stream, and the nuclear power plant that is built in Akkuyu. So the Turkish-Russian relations are very much intertwined and very much interrelated, which, to the surprise of many, didn't prevent Turkey from siding with Ukraine and also sending some military assistance, including the drones, to the Ukrainian military. So it seems like relations between Turkey and Russia are multi-sided, and it's most like a transactional relationship, I would say, rather than being a strategic relationship. And now, when it comes to China, You know, as you said, Turkey has been quite silent regarding the Uyghur issue. It has come to the parliament a couple of times, but, you know, it was not a big issue. I think Turkey is watching very carefully what China is doing in the Middle East, especially in terms of mending ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So if China is going to get involved, in the region in the coming months and years, then Turkey's foreign policy towards China might change as well.
We could go on for hours, but I just want to ask you one more question, then we'll have you back on, hopefully in the next month, because I'm sure a lot is going
to
change.
Yeah, we need to reassess.
Even before, I think we need to sort of check in a little more regularly here as things get crazy. But the wonkier question for some of the more investment-focused listeners, where does Turkish monetary policy go from here? Does the earthquake and the economic needs that Turkey is going to have actually keep Turkish interest rates low? If the opposition comes in, do they say enough with this unorthodox lunacy? We're going to, you know, restore normal monetary policy. Is Erdogan, once he's elected, if he wins and he sort of has a firm position, will he go back to the Erdogan of the early 2000s who did everything the IMF said and was, you know, did everything to a T orthodoxy? Like, how do we think about where Turkish monetary policy goes from here in these different scenarios?
So as you know, what happened after the earthquake, the central bank continued to lower the interest rates. So it is like, you know, the main policy of President Erdogan himself and, you know, therefore that of the central bank, of course. There is a strict policy to decrease interest rates. But in the real sector, in Turkish businesses, you know, paradoxically, it leads to lack of credits for corporations in Turkey. So the interest rates are low, but there is no money around. People and the corporations do have difficulties to access loans and credits. So that's one thing. What would happen if the opposition wins is that it's very clear that they're going to go back to orthodox policies. I mean, they made this very clear. As we speak today, there was an article in the Bloomberg. The economy chief of the second opposition, second biggest opposition party, the Good Party, is a Wharton professor, and he made it very clear that Turkey will go back to orthodox policies. One of the members of the Table of Six, so a minor political party in Turkey, the chairman of that minor political party, Ali Babacan, he was the economy minister of Justice and Development Party for many, many years, and he's also very well known in the Western circles as well. So he says that they know exactly what they're going to do. It's not very difficult. So they know what kind of reforms and structural reforms that they need to do to attract more money inflow into Turkey. And, based on my conversation with, Western investors, they're also anxiously waiting for some reforms to be done in Turkey for that money to flow into Turkey, right? So yeah. One of the investors from a hedge fund, told me that if things go back to normal in Turkey, it's going to be the mother of all rallies. There is a lot of potential waiting to be exploited in Turkey. I think that government will, I mean, if the current government wins and if Erdogan remains in place, they will seek ways to normalize the Turkish, economic choices. One of the signs of this was that yesterday, Erdogan had a meeting with a former economy minister, Mehmet Şimşek, who is a former Merrill Lynch professional, and he was in charge of Turkish economy for a while, so he's also very well known for his orthodox policies and his reputation in the West. But that meeting did not end up with Mehmet Şimşek accepting the role that Erdogan was suggesting. There are conflicting signs coming out of from the government's camp, but from opposition, it's quite clear going back to orthodox policies, increasing probably interest rates and the pushing for some structural reforms that will make Turkish economy attract more money in the future.
What about the scenario if the opposition won parliament but Erdogan remained president? Does that still mean Erdogan's calling the shots and you wouldn't see a lot of changes at the central bank, or would a hostile parliament force Erdogan to make some changes?
That depends on the distribution of seats in the parliament. If the opposition wins the majority in the parliament and if they get the upper hand in terms of, legislation, of course, they can change some, laws and the constitution even. constitutional amendments if it's possible. So I think that's going to be, you know, a difficult situation for whoever is in the presidential post to be very much limited. But we also need to keep in mind is that the government, the cabinet, is not elected from the parliament. That was the case in the parliamentary system, but now the president is elected and then he picks members of his cabinet. And moreover, he or she, whoever is the president, can appoint high-level public officials, including the governor of the central bank, single-handedly. So the president doesn't need approval from the parliament or another institution to appoint someone as the head of central bank or another critical institution. So that gives the president a lot of power.
All right, I'll close with an almost selfish question, which is people who have been listening to this podcast for a while know I'm very optimistic about Turkey in the long term. I've been bullish about Turkey for years. At CI, we had open positions in Turkish equities going back 2-3 years, even when people were, oh my God, the Turkish clear is collapsing, everything else. We closed most of those positions at the beginning of this year because we didn't like all the election uncertainty and we wanted to digest a little bit what was going on, and it had had a nice run. As somebody like me is thinking about Turkey in the long run, should we sort of be worried about these next few months? Is this the opportunity, as you said, for the, you know, this rally of epic proportions? How would you tell a Western investor or an external investor to think about Turkey right now?
Well, I mean, I think the key concept that I would refer to would be resilience. I mean, Turkey has proven to be resilient over many, many decades. And there is a lot of, there were a lot of ups and downs in Turkey. You know, in terms of inflation, you know, attempted coup attempts, you know, wars and conflicts and earthquakes. But, you know, this country keeps going, you know, no matter what happens. And this is why I'm here still and my family is here. And I think the country will prosper. There might be some difficult times ahead, elections and earthquake and their impacts. But I mean, in the short and medium term, Turkey will recover and come back in a much better way.
All right, well, Emre, thank you for coming on. We're going to have you back on in a couple of weeks, if that's okay with you, to check in all this stuff.
Always my pleasure. Well, I can talk about it for many, many hours, you know.
Oh, we can do this for hours. Hopefully sometime soon it'll be in Istanbul overlooking the Bosphorus and we can be...
You're more than welcome.
All right. Well, sounds good. Thanks, Emre.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to the Cognitive Dissidence podcast brought to you by Cognitive Investments. If you are interested in learning more about Cognitive Investments, you can check us out online at cognitive.investments. That's cognitive.investments. You can also write to me directly if you want at jacob@cognitive.investments. Cheers, and we'll see you out there. The views expressed in this commentary are subject to change based on market and other conditions. This podcast may contain certain statements that may be deemed forward-looking statements. Please note that any such statements are not guarantees of any future performance, and actual results or developments may differ materially from those projected. Any projections, market outlooks, or estimates are based upon certain assumptions and should not be construed as indicative of actual events that will occur.